Introducing the Jasper Cacao Project, your gateway to spiritual enlightenment through the power of cacao. This is a wholesome beverage that not only nourishes your body but also uplifts your soul. Jasper Cacao is ethically sourced, fairly traded, organically grown and crafted with love to bring you a truly transformative experience. Cacao, known as food of the gods, has been revered for centuries for its spiritual and healing properties. The Jasper Cacao Project honours this ancient tradition by offering you the purest form of cacao, free from additives and preservatives. Indulge in the rich beverages and feel the positive energy flow through you, whether you are looking to enhance your meditation practice, nourish your body with goodness, or simply savour a moment of bliss. The Cacao Project is here to accompany you on your spiritual journey. With every kilo sold, Jasper Cacao donate funds to the UK charity Plant Your Future, enabling farmers to sustainably grow their crops in the most eco-friendly way. Check out my bio for a discount on your first purchase, where you will receive 15% exclusive affiliate discount. Expanding love with every sip. Now then, witches and beautiful souls, I am back witching again and feeling almost at 100% after the last episode. I was so poorly and you could really hear it in my voice. I am so thankful for all the well wishes I received and the magic and the love via Instagram and my inbox. It was really nice to hear that people were generally worried that I couldn't speak very well, but it was a terrible cold and cough. It's gone now, thank goodness, but I spent most of that weekend in bed, and I also missed a ghost night that I was running with Jodie, and I also missed my other work, so I was really ill. Better now. Welcome to episode 29. The first solitary witch episode for quite some time now. I feel we had a hat trick of guest episode moot loots, and I hope you enjoyed them. Amy's episode was fabulous, where she was talking about the origins of folklore, and she's bringing out a book, and this witch is going to get a book, so woo, excellente. So much news, so much. I popped back into the charts briefly, and oh my gosh, drum roll, another drum roll. As of today, on the 10th of April, I have actually smashed 10,000 downloads, which is amazing! Oh my god! That's a huge milestone. And when I began, I remember reading, you know, like when you get to 10,000, it's such a big deal. I remember thinking, gosh, I'm never going to get there. But alas, I'm here just over a year and a month about that it's taken me. So thank you so much for all the downloads. I ran my friendly coven last month and it was amazing. I was so nervous at the beginning. It sold out really quickly. There weren't enough chairs. I got really hot and bothered at the beginning, but a group of witches came together and we all produced a spell in a really powerful circle to manifest some money before the next friendly coven on the 17th of April, which has also sold out. I've got a little WhatsApp group and the witches are telling me as the money rolls in. So that's really amazing. It was to manifest £100. I managed to manifest £100 in a different way to what I thought I would. So I've been looking at this tent online for ages for a fantastic tent company. I think it's called Bellamifio or something. I'll link it in the show notes. Bellissima. Bellissima Camping. Get it right, Wales. These tents are 5 metres, beautiful. And I'd actually reached out to them to come onto the podcast in the future. Anyway, so this tent, it's beautiful print and it's like £350 brand new. So I was always on the verge of buying it. And I always look on Facebook Marketplace and I saw the exact same tent the exact same print for sale on Facebook Marketplace. Now, I see a lot of stuff for sale that I desire on the marketplace. There's always something in me that makes me go, nah, that's not right. We had a couple of friends in common, which is always a good sign. This tent was brand new in box, unopened, and she wanted £300 for it, which is a really good price. So I messaged her saying, oh, I'm really interested in this tent. Are you far away? And it turns out she were less than an hour's drive away, which never happens. And then she said, I kid you not, oh, I'll take £250 for it. And I was just like, what? The goddess. So I got straight in the car and drove over there with my little one, picked up this fantastic brand new tent, still in the box, even had all the cable ties on it and everything. All it had done is sit in a storage for a year, in her attic, I believe. For £100 less, and that, my dear witches, is how beautifully the universe can provide when you'd use magic to order from the cosmic universe. I just think that's amazing. It's such a good story. Anyway, so I've got the tent now. It's a big 5 metre and I can go with my kids, pitch it up and also offer Reiki from the tent, which is a bit hard to do in the little 3 metre heavy canvas tent with all my stuff and all my kids' stuff. It went really well and I haven't published new dates yet for the friendly coven. I'll wait till the kids go back to school and then I'll get my diary out and get back to all the people that have messaged me about coming onto the podcast, and also I will set the coven dates. Oh, what else? New art. Have you seen the Bell Witch podcast has new cover art? I've been designing this maybe a week or two in the background, unsure what to do about it. And then an amazing business called The Podcast Boutique were doing free reviews of podcast art. And I know this business because I did some free masterclasses last summer with her when I started out. I didn't know what I was doing as a solo witch. And so I took a chance and I sent my picture of me looking up into the sun with my magic wand, which I really like. Beverly Thornton took that photograph. It's like the best, favouritest photo of my face ever. And she replied to me exactly as I thought she would reply, saying it's a really gorgeous photograph, but it's too dark. It doesn't stand out against other podcasts. People don't know who you are, so they don't really care what your face looks like, you know, the new listeners. Words need to be bigger in your art and it needs to stand out. So I was a bit like, yeah, thanks universe, thanks the podcasting boutique. I am going to take that as a sign, and I changed it all and I think it's worked because I seem to be getting a little bit more reach now. And I was heavily inspired by BBC Witch Art and Disney and, you know, like Sleeping Beauty tapestry type stuff. I was influenced by all that, I think you can tell. The witch is meant to be me, of course. Of course it's meant to be me, but I haven't got green hair. Not like she does. I've got a green wig though. Close, but no cigar. Speaking of Beverly, I had a little photo shoot just before I got poorly where I took my big sword that I won from Witchfest. The Witchfest and the Sax episode sword. I was desperate to get some posy pictures with it, and Beverly wanted to try in a little studio in a house instead of being out in the woods. So we had a grand old day posing and being silly and hugging her cats and drinking a tea. I shall share those pictures on the Patreon. Speaking of which, Patreon, segue, that's still going. I've got another couple of new subscribers. Louise Bloomer, the Wiccan Lady, who is one of my biggest life cheerleaders, bless her heart, and Quinn from Pagans of the North to help me get some money back into the podcast. I mentioned last episode that I have made it so you can join the Patreon for just £1.50 and then you can get ad-free listening, early access, write-ups, a journal and all that jazz. So it's right cheap, that. It's like the price of a bun from Mozza's. Of course, you can support me in other ways by just sharing the Bell Witch podcast with your friends, word of mouth, online, leave me a rating, help me get out there in podcast world. Every little helps and I really do appreciate it. And then I know I'm not talking to me sane as well. So what's this one about? At last, a solitary witch episode. This is the sister episode to Magic of the Sea. It was like another aspect of the little holiday that I really loved and that really spoke to my soul. And it was the ghost walk I did with Rose on the second night, and it was just so brilliant. And I got really inspired by the story she told and the way she told them. We ended up messaging the day after, so she knows what was going on. It was just brilliant. And there's a lot of witch-related subjects, topics, ghosts, stories, smugglers, of course. You can't really talk about Robin Hood's Bay without talking about the smugglers, because it's such a big part of its history. Oh, we haven't had a podcast pals for so long now. So shall I do the actual jingle? I'm still working on it. Ready? It's podcast pals. I quite like that one. For this podcast pals, to tie in with the theme of this episode, which is a bit ghosty and a bit spooky and a bit scary, I am going to shout out a lovely dude called Jamie and his podcast called Your Ghost Stories. I've had my eye on this one for a while. I think I found it suggested through Spotify when I was listening to Emma and Dan's podcast, Real Life Ghost Stories. And it was interesting because it started out around the same time as I did, and there was two hosts like there was on this podcast. And the guys were just really lovely and really down to earth and quite chatty. Jamie, he does it on his own and he interviews guests every week all about spooky happenings in their life. A bit of a whiz kid on the old guitar and singing. He's a proper professional singer-songwriter artist. So I think all his own music and stuff is on the podcast, which is very swish. I wish I could do that. Jamie has sent me his trailer, so I'm going to play that for you right now.
Hello and welcome to Your Ghost Stories, the paranormal podcast where we delve into the supernatural through the eyes of those who experienced it firsthand. On this show, we extend an invitation to our fascinating guests from all corners of the globe, encouraging them to share their most hauntingly terrifying and sometimes even disturbing encounters, all entirely unfiltered and in their very own words. From spine-tingling tales to downright hilarious conversations. We've got it all. So kick back and switch off the lights. Unless you're driving, of course. That would be really silly. I'm your host, Jamie, and I'm very grateful that you've decided to join me today. Hope you enjoy this week's episode.
Sounds right good. I was actually a guest on Jamie's podcast. It is episode 45, and this witch talks about my psychic mum a little bit more. A few stories I forgot to add on my episode is on Jamie's episode. So I suggest after you've listened to this episode, hop over there, give him a listen, rate him, give him some stars. It is such an awesome little podcast, and it's about 30 minutes each time, so it's easy to squeeze in there on your bus journey. So yeah, share the podcast love. I'm looking for trailer swaps, so if you've got any trailer swaps, send them to me on thebellwitchpodcast@yahoo.com and I will send you yours, and we'll do some of that swapping malarkey that's big in the business of podcasting. Oh yeah. Blimey swales, there was a lot in there. Get on with it. Robin Hood's Bay, an amazing place, and even though it was a good few months ago now, I do think about it often, and I've been meaning to create this podcast episode for some time now, all about the dark history of Robin Hood's Bay and the witchcraft and the spells and gruesome ghosts. There's so many amazing stories, I thought it could easily fill an entire podcast, and I'm going to try and keep it around a witch theme, which is quite hard because it's a vast topic, but I will do my best. So Robin Hood's Bay is a village in North Yorkshire in England. It's about 6 miles south of Whitby and 15 miles north of Scarborough on the Yorkshire coast. It's got an amazing history full of smuggling, witches and ghosts. And I decided while I was there to partake in a ghost walk run by Rose, who is a local legend and also grew up there and had plenty of stories of her own to share with us, which were quite spooky and really good. She was really engaging and she had an air of Jennifer Saunders about her. She was just so theatrical and you could tell she really loved the job. When I was walking down the hill, because I was waiting for some people and we were late, walked towards the crowd where Rose was in the middle of the crowd, you know, with like a top hat and tails looking fantastically authentic, what you imagine a ghost storyteller would look like. And she looked at me and went, "Ah, yes, I knew you were coming. We were just waiting around, but you're definitely the last, so we'll go." And I was a bit like, "Whoa, how did you know that? Are you a witch? Do you have a feeling for this?" So straight away, you know, I was a bit like, "Oh, I like this person. She knows stuff." But I'm just that person, really, like, everybody's a witch. If you have anything in common with me, you look at the spooky side of life, you know, which swales logic. So Rose has this fabulous business called the Whitby Storyteller, the Robin Hood's Bay Ghost Walk. I presume she does Whitby stories as well in the next town. Her website is thewhitbystoryteller.co.uk, and the intro page says, "Come on a unique tour through the streets and alleyways as you listen to the tales of strange and supernatural. Journey into a mysterious past of spirits, shipwreck, smugglers, local folklore and legend." Rose is a charismatic storyteller who can really capture the attention of young people. She is brimming with energy and life and brings humour, mystery and passionate love of the natural world. She also points towards important truths and can reconnect her listeners with a deep sense of meaning. And that's a quote from Dr. Justin Huxley off a website, which I think is a fantastic quote, and I absolutely agree with all of that. It's brilliant. So some of the stories I'm going to tell you tonight on the podcast are directly from Rose. I'm not going to tell everything, obviously, because you're going to have to go and see her and go on the ghost walk. I absolutely do recommend you do that, and I'll give her another shout out at the end. I'll link website in the show notes, so if you're ever around that part of Yorkshire, please do go, because it is brilliant. And I'm only going to tell you one or two things from Rose's ghost walk, and then a few I found on the internet, so it's going to be a right good old spooky ride.
It's going to be a spook fest.
I hope you enjoy it. Robin Hood's Bay lies in the ancient parish of Fillingdales. The name itself is believed to be derived from the old English word, which means marshy ground. The first evidence of man in this area was 3,000 years ago, when the Bronze Age burial grounds were dug up on the high moorland a mile or so south of the village. Locally known as Baytown back then, there was actually no evidence that Robin Hood was ever there. But the name Robin Hood has lots of little associations with the place in terms of the smuggler history, you know, like robbing the rich to feed the poor. So I think that's got connections there. But also Robin Hood is associated with ancient forest spirits from pagan folklore. And that, along with the smuggling history of the bay, I believe even helped to cement the name. While I were there, I got the feeling from Rose and other locals, not that there's many there now, but I think they're trying to call it Baytown again, and they don't actually like the name Robin Hood's Bay because of the mistaken connection with the legend of Robin Hood. Baytown kind of suits it more anyway, so I'll try and refer to it as Baytown because I just quite like that as well. It's quite cool.
Of course, I'm only speculating like I do.
Oh, all right then, let's get into it. Woo. So while we're here, I'll tell you a little bit about Robin Hood myth that's related to other legends other than Robin Hood, robbing the rich to feed the poor. So the Tree of Life is seen as Robin's larder tree, supplying all that could be required, like the Horn of Plenty or the Cauldron in the Celtic folklore.
Mythology and all that jazz.
So Robin's links with the Horn God is also telling us he's a lord and master over humans and animals of the forest. And they're guardians of the stolen treasure, like hoarding, serpent nagas of Hinduism. They do good deeds for those who deserve them and dastardly deeds for those who do not. So the element of the smugglers kind of reflects the Robin Hood folklore from paganism, which I love. The town itself today is beautiful. A quirky postcard looking town with 200 quaint houses that are like stacked up really close together. And there's a road, a really steep road that comes down the hill to the bay and then curls round and goes up again. And it just abruptly ends. And that is because the town used to be double its size at least and have 400 houses or more in it. But because the town has an atmospheric, fierce and sometimes violent bay that requires a seawall to prevent the fossil seas from taking the rest of the town with it, as it did from the 1700s all the way to 1974. A wall was built to protect 40-odd properties from the coastal erosion that was just so severe. You know, there's loads of stories of churches falling into the sea, dinging bells to warn people, you know, that they were going in. Bell ringers were like ringing as they fell to the depths, which is just crazy heroic and very sad. But because of all the houses falling into the sea, the beach is a hotspot for finding sea glass and ceramics on the beach that used to belong to the houses of the village that got lost to the sea. And I think, well, we were there, we were looking for sea glass, and my daughter found so much pottery and ceramics on the beach. When I were holding them, all I could think about were all these houses that fell into the sea, a bit like the one I saw in Scarborough, the hotel just falling down the coast into the sea. It really gets to me, actually. It's balmy. There were a graveyard on the coast, and that also fell into the sea. The story goes, you know, you could see the coffins falling out from underground, falling into the ocean, and sometimes they'd open and like skeletons would go back to the sea. And these could have been the sailors that got wrecked on the coast, that got buried, and the townsfolk were believing, you know, that they were chosen to go back to the sea because that's where their soul wanted to roam, and the body should be with the soul. So it just seems really morbid imagining open caskets and coffins just falling into the sea. It must have been such a heavy sight. It's just, wow. I don't know, it's really weird. There's just something about it. I can see it in my mind. I can imagine it and I can feel like the devastation. It's quite interesting where my emotions come from. Anyway, that is probably a theme for another episode, so let's not dwell on that, Swales. Because of how Baytown was formed, at the bottom of a hill on the bay, the moors surrounded the little town. In the 1700s, the people used to know and call the moors the Bridge of Dread, because it was vast and foreboding. There were no roads, no pathways. People didn't leave, you know, their whole life was in this little town. Everybody knew everybody. Couldn't just go jump in a car or even in a horse and go across the moors because they were treacherous. People used to leave and not come back, or even come back with ghost stories that they'd seen people wandering the landscape where the souls were lost, given to this Bridge of Dread. The moors were considered purgatory to the village folk back then because they didn't know any different, and they were scared to leave the safety of the bay and wander into the unknown moors that must have been so huge and scary back then. So everybody knows Robin Hood's Bay has a fantastic history of smugglers in the sort of 17th, 18th century. It was reportedly the busiest smuggling community on the Yorkshire coast and once in Britain. It was a big deal, and it was a bigger deal than Whitby back then. It was more important than Whitby because its fishing industry was huge and probably the main source of legal income at the time. Oh, right then, the fun bit about the smuggling and pirates and all that jazz. Here we go. Because of its natural isolation, protected by the marshy moorland and all three sides, it offered a natural aid to this well-organised business, which despite its dangers, must have paid a lot better than fishing at the time. Because tax was so high, the king at the time was really greedy and was like adding tax upon tax upon tax. So the bay folk who lived there liked the smugglers and they helped them by hiding them, passing the contraband items from house to house. And it was said that all these things like silk and gin and tobacco and rum could be passed from the sea all the way up to the top of the moors without ever seeing the light of day, because all these houses had amazing trap doors and tunnels that used to go underneath them with wooden slots to go through, revolving walls and hidden nooks and crannies. The wives of the sailors
used to protect the menfolk of the bay, be it their husbands, sailors, or even the smugglers, by pouring hot water on people who were trying to find them, banging drums and stuff, banging pans. When law enforcements were coming down the hill, people used to scurry around, can you imagine it, and hide all these smugglers. And they'd be walking around trying to find them, and there'd be just like nobody on the street. It'd be just like ghost town. I just can see it in my mind so clearly. It's so much fun. I love it. But the women there were fierce. The bay wives reportedly poured boiling water on press gangs who were trying to make sailors join the Navy at the time to go to sea on expeditions. And they'd never come back because the women knew it was so treacherous and they didn't want their loves to leave. So they'd be fierce and they'd fight. What I love about that as well is when I was at Baytown, there was a men's institute there. And I thought to myself, gosh, that's amazing. I've never seen a men's institute. I mean, there's loads of women's institutes all over the country. But I think that is such a big nod and connection to the history of the land. Do you know that the men were really loved and protected because the sea was fierce and they were being forced onto the sea to be in the Navy, to work for the guards, work for the army, whatever it was, you know, and they wouldn't come back because it was such a shit job. And even though they weren't meant to be allowed, sailors were supposed to be exempt. That didn't mean anything. So the smugglers and the sailors must have banded together, you know, to protect each other and a mutual beneficial agreement. I just love it. I love all the history and the links. It's really powerful stuff. And also the smugglers would have used the Bridge of Dread to their advantage, you know, by bringing stories of their posse getting lost in the moors and never being seen again, or tales of ghost sightings that would have scared people, local people, to leave. So like the smugglers could leave, come and go, maybe even dress up as ghosts and wander on the moors to make it more believable. I honestly do think they did that, and I think Rose mentioned they might do that too, and I was a bit like, yes, you know, I can kind of see it really. Such a good opportunity to get stuff done. If there's God-fearing, perjury-fearing bay folk of Baytown, they're going to latch onto that and they're going to use it to their advantage. It's all about money at the end of the day, isn't it? If you're a smuggler, it's about the money. Just a quick Google on smugglers in Baytown. You get loads, and the houses apparently are still connected. Some of them have been blocked up, but sometimes you can find the odd trapdoor or go under the tunnel. I think it's called the King's Passageway. Leads to the sea. You can walk under there in your wellies and a hard hat and look up, and there's still some boarded up holes, you know, that lead into houses, which is just amazing. I proper love it. It's so cool. Love a bit of history, me. Love a bit of history. Right then, shall we try and do a bit of ghosty stuff? Let's do ghosty stuff. Yes! I want to tell you the story about Bert Marshall. He was a Yorkshire farmer who was frugal with the pennies. And this Bert dude, he was just so tight and he didn't want to spend money on anything other than his alcohol, because he loved a bit of beer. He loved a bit of that right cheap smuggled gin. It was said that he even went as far as to steal a set of dentures from a corpse in the village to replace his old teeth. He would often walk along the route of the Whitby Scarborough railway line to and from the pub. Bert walked to the Windmill Inn 5 miles away every Friday night, drunk as a skunk, coming home, having a great time, singing and being silly. But one evening, he was drunk and he began to walk his regular route along the railway line. And it is said that he lost his footing, he fell over, knocked out his dentures. Yes, those stolen dentures from a dead corpse. And he toppled over, trying to find them, and landed on the railway line. And as he lay there, he became a bit unconscious because he was so drunk. And then an oncoming train came, and you know what's coming, decapitated him. Oh my God, he lost his head, quite literally. Pretty gross. People believed that it was important to be buried as a whole. The body had to be together, even if it had been cut apart, it should be back together. Or the spirit could not rest ever. His headless ghost is said to be still seen on moonless nights along the train tracks. still carrying his false teeth with him and searching for his head. And you can hear the scary chattering of his dentures that he stole from a corpse. False teeth in his hand as he roams the moors, headless and unsure what is actually going on. Pretty grim. But that's quite a famous ghost story from Baytown in North Yorkshire. There's also this rambling trail called the Lykewake Walk, which is a challenging 24-hour ramble that crosses 40 miles of North Yorkshire moors between Osmotherley, I can't bloody read it, I'm so dyslexic, in the west, and Ravenscar on the east coast. It is an exposing route with grueling climbs and boggy sections. You know, people have to know what they're doing to attempt this challenging 24-hour ramble across the scary moors. But the trail's name is really cool because like means corpse and wake is the act of watching over it. So it's called Watching Over the Corpse Walk. How cool is that? I love it. And the name originates from Lykewake Dirg. D-I-R-G-E. Dirg, is it? One of Yorkshire's oldest surviving dialect verses. What I quite like, though, if a woman completes this in 24 hours, she gets to be called a witch. She gets labelled a witch. If they report that they've done it in 24 hours to New Lykewake Club, they're eligible for a free membership. So, woo! Get in there, witches, get walking, and you can get a free membership from this amazing walking club up near Baytown. And I got that from www.komoot.com, so that's K-O-M-O-O-T.com. And there's quite a bit of history on there as well about the place. In Roman times, people who died would be walked across in coffins or whatnot on the shoulders of men to the burial ground. And it's like loads of corpses have been walked along this coastal walk. Proper cool. And a bit dark. Yes, there seems to be quite a lot of death in ancient Robin Hood's Bay. I guess because it was such a dodgy kind of piratey land at the time. There used to be a paid position called a wrecker, who was a smuggler who would lure ships into the shore with false light, you know, pretending to be a lighthouse to get ships to turn and come to the shoreline. And then once the ship crashed on the rocks, which was quite easy because it was such a treacherous bay and the seas were fierce, it was quite normal to have shipwrecks wreck on the Baytown beach because it was such a hard bay to, I guess, pull up in a ship. I don't know the terminology, but I think Rose mentioned there was quite a lot of wreckages and stuff going wrong for ships because it was such a hard sea to dock in. But once the ship crashed on the rocks, the smugglers would go in and steal the cargo and kill all the passengers so they could smuggle the cargo up through the houses. Because dead men tell no tales, right? Smuggling was a hanging offence if you were caught, so everything was just so deep underground. And I got that from thirdeyetraveller.com, the wrecker story. I thought, oh, that's pretty good. How can you live with yourself being a wrecker? But back then, they must have been making so much money, it's the worth it. And with all the superstitions around sailors being killed in the sea and, you know, the sea choosing them to die, perhaps it was just taken for granted that that is just how it was, but really it was the smugglers having a hand in it to benefit themselves. I know I kind of alluded to this on the Magic of the Sea episode, but on the ghost walk, Rose was saying, because, you know, the townsfolk were just so in their own little bubble and nobody really came in and out through the land. It were only through the sea. And obviously when they did that, they didn't hang about. People lived in harmony, you know, like, and witches and cunning folk and cunning women lived along happily on the side of the church. You know, witches and the church were fine and they'd work together and live side by side in beautiful harmony. And I guess because there were no doctors and stuff, you know, witches, of course, were
midwives using herbs to heal people, and they were loved and they were needed. And I really like that about this place.
I honestly think I can feel it.
You know, people love witches and they weren't scared of them until, I guess, people started coming in or newspapers were being printed about the witch hunts or whatever. I mean, I couldn't find much detailed stuff. It were all just stuff we already know about witch hunts, and I didn't really want to go there on this podcast. But, you know, witches used to help for the greater good, and then witches could also work with you for the evil or the greater bad, I guess you would say.
Which, let's be honest, is still the case today if you're not Wiccan.
And one of the stories Rose told me about, which I absolutely loved, was the Hand of Glory. Do you know anything about the Hand of Glory? Oh my God, it is amazing. Kind of dark voodoo magic going on right there. I think it was found in Robin Hood's Bay, and now it lives in the Whitby Museum in a glass case, looking probably gross, scary and haunted. And I was trying to convince my witchlings to go to Whitby, and they were like, nah. And I was like, oh please, I really want to see the Hand of Glory. I want to look at that dark magic. So I'm getting this off the Whitby Museum website, the whitbyguide.co.uk. The Hand of Glory is a mythical artifact that was said to heal alignments, protect thieves from discovery, and act as a warning to others of consequences of the crimes they committed. And it's a European belief that it had to be amputated off criminals to act as a deterrent, you know, like against your house being burgled. So people would probably go grave digging and buying this shit, a bit like the weird thing off the baby's head from the Magic of the Sea episode. It must have been proper grim. To create a Hand of Glory for the task of robbing somebody's house, it had to come off the corpse that was still hanging, and it had to be the right hand. So you have to assume that the person you're taking the hand from is right-handed. If they were left-handed, it probably wouldn't have been as magically pleasing as a right-handed robber. So the hand was used most often as a candle itself, though sometimes it could be a candle holder, you know, like positioned to hold a candle. In stories, it's the fingertips that acted as the candle. Each finger would represent each person in the home that was fast asleep. And if a finger wouldn't catch fire, it indicated that either somebody in the home was awake or that there were less than five people in the house. So many thieves misjudged the number of people in the house, and this was often their downfall. And it is said that the flame of the Hand of Glory can only be extinguished with milk. Any other liquid would just embolden the blaze and it'd all go wrong and you'd probably get burned, and it'd be a massive sign not to burgle that house. So how did it work? The thieves thought it would reduce their risk of getting caught at the time of the burglary. But the burglary is punishable by death, so the stakes were really high. So, you know, it was worth going to a witch asking advice on how to make a Hand of Glory. So the first thing that is most common that people know about is this hand would put anybody to sleep who was in the house and make them in a coma-like state until the flames were extinguished, you know, after the burglary had gone well. The second is the hand would only give light to the holder casting the spell and put all others into darkness. The holder would become invisible, so if there were a gang of you robbing a house, the person who had made and had this Hand of Glory would be invisible to everybody as the magic would shield them. And also, this Hand of Glory could unlock any locked door so people could enter freely, because the magic was thought to hinder all working locks. And people thought that it would burn forever if it wasn't put out without milk put on the fingers or the hand to extinguish it. That means if you forgot to blow it out, I guess the people who were in the coma-like state would probably die. You know, it was a big deal. I got this book. It's about witches in North Yorkshire. It's fantastic. Great read. And there's actually a Hand of Glory recipe for thieves. Are you ready for this? Have you got your pen and notepad ready to take notes on this fabulous recipe for a Hand of Glory? Take the severed right hand of a hanged man and remove all tendons and fat. Dry the hand in a mixture of salt, pepper and salpetre, don't know what that is, and then smoke in the chimney for at least 3 weeks. So this is like a long recipe. You've got to be prepared. In the meantime, form the fat from the hand into a small candle. When the hand is prepared, take it to the house of the rich person and place the hand on the doorstep with the candle in the palm of the hand. Light it and repeat these following lines. Okay, here comes a spell. Let those who rest more deeply sleep. Let those awake their vigils keep. On hand of glory shed thy light. Direct us to our spoil tonight. The people in the house will immediately fall into a deep slumber. All the locks will open and the housebreaker may carry out his crime with no danger of detection. So this is an official recipe in The Witches of North Yorkshire written by Michael Ray. And then it goes on to tell us about a hand of glory. The witch is called Betty Struthers. Betty was an expert at making hands of glory, and they worked very well, so Benjamin soon became a successful burglar, earning many times more than the £20 he owed. Within 2 months, he was sitting at the top table of the alehouse, amongst the boldest of thieves, laughing and drinking, admired by all. But Benjamin was a greedy man, and as the time to pay Betty neared, he began to fret the thought of paying her so much for what was just a bit of cooking. And then an idea came to him. He realised that Betty could not complain to an investigator, as if he refused to pay her. For although the laws against witchcraft had been done away with, claiming to be a witch was still punishable by years imprisonment and 4 sessions in the stocks where she would be pelted with rotten fruit. He also realised that although Betty was a powerful witch and could not use these powers against him, if he consulted a wise man, skilled in countering the spells of witches, he could obtain sufficient charms to make her incapable of harming him. And so he paid a visit to a local knowledgeable wise man in Scarborough and soon felt fully protected from the power of all witches at a fraction of the price he would have owed to Betty. So it was that at the end of the year, Betty waited vainly in her little cottage for Benjamin to appear. The next morning, she set out walking to Thirsk, which is quite far from Robin Hood's Bay, may I add, and found Benjamin in the alehouse. Betty glared at him. "Where's my money?" she said. Benjamin clenched his thumb in a fist and shook it at her face. "You'll get no money from me," he jeered. "Look here." And he opened his coat to reveal the charms he had gathered to protect himself. Betty turned and walked out to the door and paused there, shouting, "No good will come of it, mark my words," and then she left. Benjamin was correct in believing that Betty could not harm him, but she was not entirely helpless. She dug up a little tin from her back garden, from which she took the attendants, of which she had removed from Benjamin's hand of glory spell. During its preparation, she rolled them in the leaf of a certain herb and threw them, herb and tendon, into the fire. That very night, at midnight, shortly after Benjamin had climbed in through the window of yet another rich farmer's house, the fingers of the hand began to curl, snuffing out the candle in its palm, destroying the power of the hand forever. Just as he was peering into a drawer, Benjamin felt something cold on the side of his head, and it was the barrel of the outraged farmer's gun. The constable was called and poor Benjamin was carried off to gaol. To jail, I think that is. Not a J, but a G. G-A-O-L. Gale. Jail.
This is a dyslexic's nightmare.
Benjamin appeared in court. The hand of glory was produced as evidence against him, convincing the jury that he was a hardened professional criminal with magic inside him. Found guilty, the judge felt that the whole weight of the law must be applied. Putting a black cloth over his wig, he looked gravely at Benjamin and said, "You are convicted of housebreaking,
a felony
to the first order. The sentence of this court is that you will be taken from this place to a place of execution, and there you will be hanged by the neck until you are dead, and may Christ have mercy on your soul. And so we see him at the start of this tale, locked in a cell, sobbing in terror as Betty bargains with the hangman, keen to obtain the raw material for her next Hand of Glory. Hey, karma is a bitch and it'll bite you on the ass. That was a very good tale of the circle of life, dear witches. Hand of Glory, it's in Whitby Museum and I'm desperate to go see it. I should go and have an artist date there and just stare at it for like an hour and try and see if I can get any scary visions in my mind. But I think the Hand of Glory was found in Baytown and then taken over to Whitby Museum. And there's only a handful of Hands of Glory in the world. And I think there's quite a lot in Europe. One being in North Yorkshire, which I'm particularly proud of as a Yorkshire lass. Definitely on my bucket list right there. To see it, not to make one. I'm going to give you another story from this excellent book called Old Nan's Revenge. Old Nan was a homeless outcast who wandered over the North Yorkshire moors begging for bread, a place to sleep. Some people were kind and fed her, pressed a penny or two into her hands, but the majority shunned her. She was a dirty old witch, although no one had ever heard of her casting spells or cursing anyone. There once was a tinker, a mender and a seller of pots and pans, who was making his way along a quiet road. The sun was just rising and he had hopes of getting to the market early doors to sell his wares. Pots and pans clinked merrily on his open cart as the old horse plodded along. Suddenly, his horse was halted. Old Nan stepped out from a little byway at the side of the road. Tim Smith, the tinker, had always suspected that Old Nan was a witch. And this confirmed his belief, for witches have the powers to stop horses in their tracks. He smiled, however, for he had a witchwood whip.
Bloody hell, sounds a bit mean, that, doesn't it?
And had only to wave it over the animal's head to break the old crone's power. He had waved the whip, but nothing had happened. Old Nan took the horse's bridle and began to lead it down the little byway. And he brought the whip down on her arm, and it was said that it passed harmlessly through her body. What? Tim shook with fear, for he realised he was looking at a ghost or worse. For along the track stood a little hill, which had a reputation of being full of cruel fairies, who sometimes dragged humans down the hill, never to be seen again.
Do remember, this is considered the land of purgatory.
Nan stopped the horse at a little cave and pointed. "It's for her," she whispered. "It's my treasure. I saved it for her." Tim looked into the cave and saw hanging there 5 bags overflowing with gold coins. "You can have 5 coins for yourself," she said, "the best from each bag, but the rest you must take to my daughter, for, you see, they took her away from me when she was just a baby on account of me being a little mad and a beggar. So all I could ever do for my baby, you must help." Tim looked fearfully at the cave. Was it a trick? Would the entrance close up behind him when he entered and the fairies grab him? Eventually his greed got the better of him. He ran in and grabbed the bags, and each one of the bags, clearly sewn in, was the name and address of Nan's daughter. Dashing out of the cave again, he looked around, but there was no sign of Nan. 10 whole years passed, and Tim the Tinker was no more. He had put his 5 gold coins to good use, along with the rest of them, for he had never delivered the bags to Old Nan's daughter. He became a rich merchant, and instead of driving the car, he rode a thoroughbred horse. One evening, Tim was riding out to take in the air on the hills. He had gone as far as he ever went, for he never passed the place where he had met Nan's ghost. He was just turning for home when, glancing over his shoulder, he saw a figure of Old Nanny sitting on the horse's rump. In terror, he began to thrash his whip at her over his shoulder, but the lashes passed through the space
and into the flank of his lively thoroughbred. The horse immediately began to gallop wildly along the road in the direction which Tim never dared to go to. Desperately, he tried to slow the horse, but with no success. It plunged on, maddened by his pulling of the reins. Somewhere along the winding moorland road, Tim fell, tangled in his stirrups, and he was dragged along the gravel road to his death. The horse and its mangled rider were found the following day where a little byroad turns off from the main highway. The coroners reported it to be an accident, noted that the horse was grazing peacefully, but that when Tim's battered corpse had an awful look on its face, a look not of pain, but of dreadful terror. Never cross a witch, especially a ghost witch or a witch ghost in the moors. Late at night or during the day, or just do what they ask you, yeah? Just do what they ask you. And this story segues nicely on to the next little thing I'd like to talk about, which is a cave. Now, do you think that cave in the story is Boggle Hole? Boggle's Hole is an amazing little cave just near Baytown. A short walk on the beach or a long walk over the tops of the cliffs towards the famous Boggle Hole Hostel, which a lot of people love and remember. You can walk down to the side of the running water stream, and then there's this little cave there, and it's not very deep, but I was desperate to go there. I had to wade through water to get to it because I was just so desperate to go in there. And that's got some fantastic folklore of its own. Rose mentioned growing up with the Boggle Hole in her childhood and the stories that were told, and they believed them. I mean, like Amy said last episode, you know, folklore starts off as a tale that we tell our children and young people, a cautionary tale to scare them off going somewhere where they might get hurt or get killed, like the big black dog, you know, like Shook. See that black dog, you might die. Go into a cave, there might be smugglers there that'll kill you, or the tide could come in and you could be trapped and drown in there. That'll be why Boggle Hole Gnome or Goblin was created, and it worked. Rose said, I would never go in there, you know. The stories were just so powerful, it worked. Legend has it that these little creatures have lived in the caves along the coastline for centuries. In years gone by, it is said that the locals would call upon the mystical healing powers of the Boggles, the Hobbs and the Goblins. Further up the north coast in Yorkshire, on the Cleveland Heritage Coast, near Runswick Bay, you'll find the Hub Hole. The story goes that this hub could cure whooping cough, or kink cough as it was known back then, although the men of the village were too frightened to go late at night near it any time. The desperate women would carry their sick children to the hob hole and ask for help and healing for the sick child, because it was so magical. And so they would recite this rhyme, sort of like a spell,
an incantation.
Hob, hole, hob, my burn's gotten kink cough, take off, tack toff. It's not the greatest rhyme I've ever heard in my life, but there you go, that's the rhyme. Locals would often say that they could hear faint laughter and echoes in the caves, attributing to these mysterious sounds to the presence of the mischievous beings. You know, I guess like fairies, they were really mischievous and not to be trusted. And the tales of the hobgoblins have been passed down through generations, with added magic each time to keep this picturesque landscape going. Of course, it was a smuggler's heaven. Smugglers, again, like the Moors, they would have probably latched onto this and reported seeing hobgoblins and Boggles coming out and attacking them when they were trying to hide stuff in there. So don't go in there, because you might see a goblin, aka you might find my treasure and steal it for yourself. Just trying to find some information on it, but there's not much. I mean, not just from Googling anyway, probably books. But I Googled hobgoblin because I don't really know what that is, you know, hobgoblin. I know it's a beer, but I'm pretty sure that's not the one I'm talking about. Google says a hobgoblin is a mischievous creature of folklore often described as a small, hairy imp causing benign or spiteful trouble. They're rooted in English mythology and embody unpredictable natures of domestic spirits. In some folklore traditions, hobgoblins were malicious rather than mischievous, and in medieval times they were associated with the devil. Oh, it always comes back to the devil. Boo, devil, boo. Sometimes they were represented as clothed in suits of leather, and sometimes they wore green. Oh yeah, I like the green stuff, that's good. I suppose that ties into the Robin Hood and the pan and all that kind of jobby. Yeah. The term hob means elf, and the earliest use of the word can be traced back to the 1500s. Wow, that's old. Oh, Robin Roundcap. Not to be confused with Robin Redcap. Haunted Spladdington Hall in East Yorkshire was a heath spirit of true hobgoblin type. He helped thresh the corn and performed other domestic chores, but when he was in the mood for mischief, he would mix the wheat and the chaff grain, kick over the milk pail, extinguish the fire. He is said to be confined in a well for a stipulated number of years through the prayers of free clergymen. This is well known as Robin Roundcap's Well. Oh, that's cool. I like that. Dobby is another term for a hobgoblin in Lancashire and Yorkshire. According to folklorist Elizabeth Mary Wright, especially one that is a relentless prankster. Much like the boggart, a Dobby's pranks may become so troublesome that a family decides to move elsewhere, only to find that the Dobby has followed them.
Oh, mate, good for you.
One version of his tale involves Robin Roundcap. However, one Yorkshire Dobby, or Hob, lived in a cave and was noted for curing children of whooping cough. There you go, that's our man, that's what we're talking about. Dobbies could be just as industrious as other hobgoblins and brownies, fairies that is, which led to the expression, Master Dobbs has been helping you. How cool is that? Whenever a person has accomplished more work than expected. So that's where the saying comes from the old hobgoblins helping out.
Are goblins quite big then? When you think of them, are they like fairy size? I don't actually know the answer to this. When I think of goblins that live in caves, like our hobble cave dude, I imagine them huge, like giants, but then I guess that's not going to work. Maybe they're along the fairy realms and they are tiny in size so they can hide within the rocks, perhaps. I'm just going on a merry little wonder here. I've had a few glasses of red wine now, so I'm enjoying myself.
It was a very nice cave, and I love that women took the babies there to get cured. So this hobgoblin, he were all right, really, wasn't he? He were all right. I think it were the smugglers that probably turned it negative. And also the rise of the church and all that job to stomp out any pagan-related folklore, probably. I'm speculating, but it doesn't feel far-fetched. So, yeah, it was bringing it back to Baytown now. I'm running out of notes, so I think I've told you quite a lot of stuff. Annoyingly, because I wrote these notes down so long ago now, and then life got in the way, I wrote down eye garland, which makes me think of all kinds of horror movie scenes. Rose must have mentioned an eye garland, and I thought, oh, I'll remember that, and I obviously haven't, so maybe it was something about eyes twinkling on a cliff. I don't know, you can't win them all, but I can just imagine it being a really scary story. So perhaps you should let's go and do the ghost hunt, people. Go through the ghost hunt. Rose was saying a lot of the cottages in the Robin Hood's Bay area are really haunted, and people see shapes in windows passing by at certain times, smelling smoke and hearing knocks on wood. And I was looking for other ghost stories on the old internet, like I do. Came across this marvellous story called The Smoking Ghost from 2011 on yourghoststories.com by the mermaid
purse. So if you're listening, I'm going to read out your story. Well, I won't read it out, but I'll paraphrase it. So this experience happens in Baytown, in one of the cottages that is the windows, you can face the sea. So it's a beautiful cottage. So I think this person was staying with her family, like her auntie and her uncle. Oh, they'd visited them on holiday, that were it. And they were playing cards. And her uncle had gone out for some fresh air after dinner. And she would just sat with her aunt and her mum. And it was dark outside. And they were playing games and started to smell smoke. Like a faint, sweet waft of smoke in the room. Obviously, none of them smoked. And it would probably have been a no-smoking place if they were renting it as a cottage. And as the game continued, the smell got stronger and stronger, until it was distinct scent of pipe tobacco smoke. And they were trying to ignore it, you know, just sort of randomly going, oh, I wonder what that's about. Carried on playing cards. The person who wrote this said she started to feel just like really, really sad, like miserable. She felt alone and hated and ended up bursting into tears just randomly over this card game. And the feeling went away really quickly after that. And she felt normal and started being like, what was that about? It was just really weird. And the smell had gone. But about the same time, her uncle burst through the door out of breath. As he said, he'd saw a dark figure leaving the room, the dining room.
You know, like he could see it through the window and it really spooked him out.
And when asked if the figure was, you know, like someone from their family, and he said that it was just too tall to be any of them. And it was quite frightening. He thought there was an intruder in the house. And this corresponded with the smell of the smoke she'd experienced. And that night, she couldn't sleep because she was proper scared. I think it's really interesting because she smelt the smoke and they were trying to sort of shrug it off. And it just gradually got so much more powerful until, if it was a spirit, they transferred the emotions to it. I just think that's such a fantastic story, and that's from me just surfing the web looking for
personal stories
related to the bay. So thank you for that, the mermaid's purse. It's a really awesome true story from all the way back when, in 2011. So I think I'm coming to an end now, and it has been a fantastic ride through a bit of history, a bit of folklore, some supernatural sea stuff, sailor stuff, smugglers. It is such a rich place and I really, really love it. And I'm so happy that I've found that connection. I'm no historian. I'm not academically trained whatsoever. I just find certain aspects of life and death interesting. And I want to talk to you about it. Not from an academic point, but just from a humble Yorkshire witch's point who likes to ponder and learn in easy language, non-jargony, probably not doing the history justice, but just showing love and respect and appreciation for the stuff I learn and the people that I meet along the way. Rose was so lovely, and she tells me she's writing a book all about ghosties of the coasties, and when that happens, I really hope she comes on to the Bellwitch podcast and talks to us about her passion, that is the place where she grew up and all its magical history and haunting tales of love and loss. I'll be well up for that, Rose, so if you're listening, please do let me know when you're going to be published. Robin Hood's Bay, or Baytown as it's locally known, is a place that allows us to glance and experience life before that capitalism seeps in to the lovely town and takes away the quaintness and the honesty of it and the independent businesses. To quote Rose, I thought it was fantastic. She called it the blandscape, where cash points and Starbucks appear on street corners and steal the land off the local businesses just for our convenience. They don't need that. The businesses that I went to, they were thriving and it was lovely to see. And I'm glad there isn't a Starbucks. If you go, do take cash, because there is no cash points. Every pub is proper traditional. And I just hope that never happens and that Rose continues to tell beautiful stories with a pagan element at the end. She signed off beautifully saying how
We need to stop feeding the monster that is capitalism and, you know, connect to the land, connect to the sea. We are becoming hungry ghosts ourselves, trying to fill the void of connection with technology and money-oriented experiences, when really we just need to look inwards and connect more with the land and its history, ancestors and each other. And I just thought that was such a beautiful and quite witchy way to end the ghost walk from Rose, and may her business continue to thrive. And yeah, go to Robin Hood's Bay, it's amazing. May the landscape never seep into the beautiful land of Baytown, North Yorkshire, also known as Robin Hood's Bay. You have been listening to the Bellwitch Podcast, Witching in the 21st Century, created with love and magic by me, Swales, the Friendly Green Witch. Official podcast photographer is Beverly Thornton. Intro music is by Jeff Harvey of Pixabay. The podcast is made on WavePad Master and distributed via Zencaster. If you have your own little witchy, spooky podcast, feel free to message me for a trailer swap. Fancy being a guest on the show? Or have you got a desired topic you'd like me to cover? Then please email me on thebellwitchpodcast@yahoo.com. If you are enjoying the show, please leave me a review or a rating. And follow the Bellwitch Podcast wherever you listen. It really does help the podcast to survive. Thank you so much for listening. Have a great day and stay magical, witches!